This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Bill Exeter. Bill is the Chief Executive Officer, Chief Trust Officer, and President for the Exeter Group of Companies. Bill has been in the banking, trust, and fiduciary service industry since 1980. He's been specializing in real estate tax strategies since 1985, with a specialty emphasis in 1031 and 1033 exchanges, as well as self-directed IRAs. Bill has successfully dealt with probably every 1031 exchange we've had for as long as I can remember. And that's an important thing to say, because there's a lot of trust involved in 1031 exchanges. So Bill, thank you for taking good care of us.
You're most welcome. That explains why my hair is half gone too, I think.
How long has 1031 exchange been around? You know, sometimes when you get these amazing tax rule changes, sort of like you can make 500 grand on your house every 2 years. When that was written, I called the smartest guy I knew going, is this really true? So that day had to happen when 1031 exchanges were invented. How long has it been around?
This is actually the 100th year anniversary of 1031 exchanges. They've been around a long time.
Wow. That's an amazing thing. And what was the thought process behind, I think we should be able to sell all this stuff and never pay taxes, because it's an amazing gift.
It really is. I mean, if you go back 100 years, the kind of the root cause or reason for it was that back then we didn't have the ability to value assets like livestock, things like that. And so the 1031 exchange is really devised to allow farmers and people like that to swap assets that they say, well, I think these are, for the most part, equal value. We don't know how to value them, so we're not going to tax it on that. And it's evolved from that to what we have today.
Okay. It never occurred to me that it started with inventory other than real estate. So it covered the gamut for in the early years.
It really did. In fact, we were able to do 1031 exchanges on any type of asset held for rental, investment, or business use up until the Tax Reform Act of 2017. And that's the one that eliminated personal property. So ever since January 1st, 2018, we've only been able to do 1031 exchanges on real estate.
Rumor has it that they're looking at saying we maybe want to disallow 1031 exchanges. So who's in charge of defending that in front of people that make those decisions? And what do you think the likely outcome of that will be?
Good question. Yeah, there is that nasty rumor out there. And it started back in when it was the Biden campaign, and they had proposed limiting it or eliminating it completely if you made more than $400,000 a year. And then, of course, once it was the Biden administration, they proposed allowing investors to defer up to $500,000. They didn't clarify much there. So if you fast forward to today, about a month ago or so, the Green Book came out, which is Biden's kind of proposed budget or wish list. And, you know, a lot of that's not going to happen. He won't get everything he's asking for, but it does give us a view into what his wish list is and what he's trying to do. And it did clarify that if these things go through, his cap will be $500,000 in total taxable gain you can defer per year per taxpayer. So husband and wife could defer up to $1 million. But that's just his wish list. And to kind of go back in time, I've been doing this for 37 years. Every 3 to 5 years, we have some type of a proposed change or proposed elimination of 1031 exchanges. And it's usually all about education. It's usually somebody in the back office has thought about erasing Section 1031 from the tax code. And if that occurs, look at all this tax revenue we're going to collect. And as you know, Bruce, in reality, a lot of investors wouldn't sell. And then you have two title companies, two escrow companies, two realtors, et cetera. They don't collect a fee. They don't pay tax. So it's actually a tax loser.
Yeah. See, that's that was interesting because that was really my next question is, okay, what are the ramifications of that? And you're right. Brokers don't get commissions and probably people don't sell and upgrade what they own. They just sit there. So it's not a tax revenue generator at all. It's a very bad idea for the economy, just like capital gains tax. Okay, we've had capital gains tax equal to the highest tax rate before, and it didn't raise revenue. People just didn't sell their stuff. So, absolutely. You know, it's frustrating when you see this going on and going, wait a minute, we have charts go back a long time. We already know how this plays out. So it's sort of like grandstanding to make everybody happy, but the net revenue doesn't occur. So what's the point? Why don't we think of another way?
And that's exactly it. It's just one more thing they can throw out there. And it makes him look good because he's trying to tax the rich. And, you know, that's another point in our business. We've never really computed the numbers, but I would say give or take about 95% of our clients are not phenomenally wealthy people. I mean, they're just average, you know, Dick and Jane who own a couple rental properties and they do exchanges to trade up, or they're business owners who need to trade up. And this helps them get there and create more jobs. Most of the business is not done by the wealthy.
That's interesting. The types of property that can participate in a 1031 exchange, what are they?
So it's a very broad list. A lot of people get hung up on the term like kind.
Yeah.
And literally like kind means you're selling real estate, you have to buy real estate. Simple as that. So like-kind real estate could include any type of real estate that's held for rental or held for investment. I differentiate between the two because rental, obviously, you bought something, you rent it or lease it out, you collect income. But you could also buy real estate of any type and just hold it for capital appreciation. It might be land, vacant land, dirt, what have you. It might be a condo. You just buy it and hold it for a capital appreciation and then sell it later. So hold for investment also qualifies. Could be real estate used in a trader business too. So any of that would work.
One of the things that's so always challenging is investors are creative. So we don't intentionally cross lines, but we do it accidentally because we think outside the box. So what you just said, so let's say I sell a building and I buy a condo and I it's going to be in a hot area and it's going to go up in value. And I don't even rent it. I leave it vacant and I use it. Is that a problem?
Well, good question. So you could certainly hold it and hold it for capital appreciation. If you use it personally, and let's say you use it for maybe 2 weeks a year, there's a safe harbor, that's okay. If you go over 2 weeks per year, you're in uncharted territory, you're outside the safe harbor. Then it boils down to facts and circumstances. So if you rent it, let's say 8 or 9 or 10 months out of the year and you use it for 30 days, you're probably okay. If you use it for 30 days and there's no rental activity, it's probably not okay. It's probably going to be classified as a second home or a vacation home for personal use, and the 1031 exchange will be disqualified.
Is that painful?
Today, yes. The tax consequences, especially if you're in California, could be 30 to up to almost 40% if everything kicks in. Under the proposed changes with the Biden administration, it would be exceptionally painful. I don't think all of those are going to go through, but if he gets some of what he wants, it's going to be even more painful.
Okay. The number of days, there's two categories of times. So kind of go over that for us. We're sitting in a building that's in escrow. So I'm going to be doing a 1031 exchange with you here very shortly. So how many days after closing do I have to say this is what I'm going to buy?
A good question, especially in today's market. That's really the challenge. When the escrow closes, so it's all about the close of escrow. It's not when you sign the contract or open escrow. It's the close of escrow that triggers everything. And once escrow closes, let's say escrow closes today, then tomorrow would be considered day number one. And you've got 45 calendar days to actually identify what you're going to buy. And in today's market, that's the toughest part because this is a fast market, multiple offers, bidding wars, tight inventory, you name it. It's a challenging market. And then after the 45 days, you have an additional 135 days to actually complete and close on your purchases. And that's a total of 180 days. So 45 to ID, an additional 135 days to wrap it up, a total of 180.
So I'm going to sell one commercial building, and can I nominate any number of replacement properties, or is there a limit on what I can exchange into as far as numbers?
There's no real limit on what you can exchange into, but where it gets complicated is you have three different identification rules. So one is the three property rule. You can't identify more than three properties, but there's no limit on value. If you want to identify more than three properties, then you would look at the 200% rule. And with that rule, there's no limit on the number of properties. The limit is on the value that you identify. So if you sell a commercial office building, let's just say it's $5 million, 200% would be $10 million. You could identify up to $10 million of value. There's no limit on the number of properties. And you only have to comply with one of those two.
Okay.
And the third one is the 95% exception. And that's really designed for a portfolio acquisition. We had a lady a while back identify 40 properties, 40 single family residential properties. And we called her and said, you're over three, you're over the 200% limit, but it was one contract, one seller, one closing. She's either going to buy 100% or zero. So in that case, she falls into the 95% because she bought 100%.
Okay. When I, you know, I mean, obviously the commercial building is in my name or my an entity that I have. When a 1031 exchange starts, the money goes to your side of the table. Are you technically the seller in that sense, or just the recipient of the money? How does that work?
Kind of both. So one of the requirements is that the 1031 exchange be set up prior to closing. And part of that documentation package includes an assignment document. So the purchase and sale agreement to sell the property is assigned to us as qualified intermediary. So that really means we are stepping into your shoes. We become the seller, and that's what prevents the tax consequence. And then at the closing, the right to receive the proceeds goes to us. They'll wire the funds to us, and we deposit that into your qualified trust account. And that's what defers everything. If the 1031 exchange is not set up prior to closing, even if you tell escrow, don't disperse the funds, I'm going to do a 1031 exchange, it's taxable because you have the right to the proceeds. So that's the key issue there. Get everything set up before closing and the funds do come to us.
And part of that is setting up an LLC, right?
Yes. Well, it depends on the transaction. If it's a reverse 1031 exchange or an improvement 1031 exchange, then we have to take title to one of the two properties involved in the transaction. So in that case, we'd set up an LLC. We generally acquire and hold, or what the IRS calls park legal title to the replacement property. That's because you're buying first, or you're going to buy first and then construct on the property. In a standard regular forward 1031 exchange, you're selling first. In that case, there's no LLC involved, so we would actually just structure and set up the 1031 exchange. The proceeds are coming to us, and we hold them in our trust company.
Let's say that I get the commercial building sold for $1 million, and I find $1 million property. One property I nominate, that's it, and we go past the 45 days, and the seller says, you know what, something happened in my life. I can't sell you the property.
And that falls into the ouch category.
Yes.
So if you've identified properties, whether it be one or three, or if you use the 200%, whatever you've identified, you can change your mind as long as you are still inside the 45-day window. Once you pass that 45-day window, then you can't change your mind. You're stuck with what your final identification was. So in that example, if you identified one property and you're past the 45 days and the seller has anything that changes his mind, he can't sell to you, or for whatever reason, you decide not to buy it because of maybe due diligence turns something up and you decide not to proceed with it, then it becomes a failed exchange and it's taxable at that point. There's no way to go back and unring the bell, so to speak. So it becomes a failed exchange and taxable.
So when we know it's a failed exchange, is that the money then is released? Or do you have to wait to the 180 days for that to be released?
Oh, that's a good question. That also triggered kind of another thought. So I'll kind of expand the answer. It's my favorite answer. It depends. The clients hate that answer. It depends. But if you're in the 45 days, then we have to wait till the 46th day. And once the 46th day occurs, if nothing's been identified, we can release the funds on the 46th day. If you've identified property and then for whatever reason you can't close on that, then under the Treasury regulations, we have to wait till the 181st day. So those are kind of the requirements. But we're now on July 1st and going forward, we're in the second half of 2021. So in this case, if your sale closes going forward, your 180th day lands in 2022. So the 1031 exchange works in conjunction with Section 453 of the tax code. That's the installment sale code. So because under the Treasury regulations, you're not allowed to have access to your funds until the 181st day, and that happens to land in 2022, it actually pushes the gain into 2022. You can also elect to take the tax hit in 2021 if that's better for you. So even if your exchange fails, there could be some year-end planning opportunities there based on the tax code.
You know what's fun about talking to you, to be honest with you, is you can forget, how am I going to say this? No matter how much I try to learn, it's like you've forgot more than I will ever know, if you know what I'm saying. It's like you live and breathe this stuff.
Which I think makes me a sick puppy.
I understand. I have one of those things in charts. You know, I have a passion for that too. So what happens if that just doesn't seem fair. I'd like to nominate a property in arrears and make that 45 days happen still. What happens when I try to do that?
Good question. So technically, obviously you're doing it on purpose. So in that case, the investor is effectively trying to backdate his identification form. That puts the investor into tax fraud category or areas. And if it's done on purpose, if the service wanted to, they could go down the criminal tax fraud path because they're really doing it on purpose. So in that case, under audit, they would disqualify the exchange because it wasn't effectively identified during the 45-day window. They would trigger all the capital gain and depreciation recapture and any other related taxes that might be due. It would trigger interest income from the day they should have paid it to the day they actually pay it. And in this case, because it was effectively intentional, they would charge penalties. Penalties could be up to 50% of what you actually owe on the taxes.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about that. So that's one of the places where you don't get creative.
Yeah, it's not a good idea to do that. And other providers, like there, you know, in any geographic area you go, there's always one or two qualified intermediaries that you hear about that will do that. And that means they're also participating in criminal tax fraud. And anybody who normally does that is asking for trouble. At some point in the future, somebody will get caught and It's not going to be a pretty picture.
When I close the sale of my property and the proceeds go into your side of the world, correct?
Correct.
Are there examples where what I thought was my money disappears?
Yes. And in fact, I've not been doing this for 37 years, like I said before, and there's been numerous qualified intermediaries that fail. And that's the sad part, is that it happens. And in most cases, it's been some type of misappropriation of funds or fraud or something like that. And occasionally it's been just poor investments. Probably the biggest one, the most well-known, is the Land America 1031 exchange, which was due to the 2008 recession. Mm-hmm. In their case, there was no fraud or misappropriation of funds. They were investing in auction rate securities. Those are not bad investments, but they're absolutely not prudent for 1031 exchange funds. And in February 08, I believe, or 09, I can't remember, the auction rate securities market froze. So that kind of forced them into a Ponzi scheme. And, new money coming in was used to pay outgoing money. And then the market and the recession got worse. That was less coming in, more going out. They had to use corporate capital to cover the outflow. And that ultimately brought the entire Land America family down. The title, all their title companies, their escrow companies, the exchange company. And they ended up in bankruptcy. And most qualified intermediaries hold the funds in their corporate name, which is perfectly okay from a 1031 exchange perspective. But when you end up in bankruptcy, the court ruled like they should have, which is these are not client funds. These are qualified intermediary corporate funds.
Yeah.
So it's critical that the funds are held in either a qualified escrow or qualified trust account. That was one of the big reasons we started Exeter Trust Company, so that all the funds are held in a qualified trust account through Exeter Trust. That also makes us one of the few that has any licensing or regulatory or government oversight as well.
Okay. Well, that's always a scary thought, you know, because I have had, I get those calls once in a blue moon. My 1031 exchange money just disappeared. Like, oh boy, that's not good.
Yep. And it's kind of a double whammy. The money disappears. So therefore you can't complete your exchange. Therefore it becomes taxable. And you just get this really nasty circle of events that starts to happen.
Yes. Because of the coronavirus, we actually have run into this where we have a 1031 exchange and all of a sudden timeframes to construct through no one's fault have changed. They couldn't get lumber. You couldn't work, or they closed the lumber mills to create the lumber, et cetera. How does the IRS handle something that's out of the control of all the participants? Are there evidences that they say, we get it? Not just this time. There's been times in the past where they have probably said, okay, we get it. Did they handle this one that way yet? Or is that maybe still to come?
I think they've done what they're going to do. I don't think we're going to see anything further. If we do, that would be fantastic. It'd be a surprise. But everything they did was actually last year in 2020. And you're right. This is something they do off and on. Usually it's some type of a natural disaster. So a fire, a flood, a hurricane, tornado, what have you. And if the taxpayer or the affected properties are in the disaster zone that has been declared by the president, then the IRS will grant an extension of 120 days. So that either means the 45-day identification period gets extended by 120 days, or the 180-day exchange period gets extended by 120 days. Last year with COVID-19, it was kind of an uncharted territory. It wasn't a date-specific event. There wasn't a natural disaster on March 1st. It was a medical disease that just kind of kept on going, the gift that keeps on giving, so to speak. So they did something really different that was odd. And what they did is, if your transaction closed or occurred between April 1st and July 1st, your deadlines were extended to July 15th. So it was a really odd way to approach that. If your transaction started April 1st, you got a great extension. If your transaction started July 1st, you got a couple days extended, and didn't really help a whole lot. And there's been nothing since then. So at this point, if they've missed the deadline, it's difficult to say what might happen. So some of the clients have said, we're going to continue anyways and report it and just say, look, we couldn't get it done because of COVID-19 related issues. But the service doesn't really have authority to extend those deadlines unless the president declares a disaster and then further declares timeframes.
Okay. When I'm selling a property that has debt on it, and I exchange, let's say, first of all, right before it closes, is it okay for me to pay off the debt and exchange into free and clear properties? Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. If I have debt and I go to an exchange and the debt is paid off during the escrow, what are the rules about me replicating the debt and or the penalty if I don't?
Good question. So the debt can certainly be paid off through closing. It has to be, obviously. At that point, then let's say you've got $1 million asset, you've got $600,000 in debt, $400,000 in equity. You go to reinvest. Whether you buy one property or you buy two properties, the total amount of what you buy is what matters. So as long as you buy something that's equal or greater than $1 million to satisfy your full reinvestment requirement, and then you move over all of your equity, so all the $400,000 of equity in that example get reinvested, and you can allocate between multiple properties any way you want as long as you reinvest all of it.
Okay.
And then generally, you're going to replace your debt. So if you got $600,000 in debt on the new purchases, you're going to get another $600,000 in debt. Although contrary to what you read on the internet, which often says you have to replace your debt, you can replace your debt with out-of-pocket cash if you want to. So it doesn't have to be debt, but you do have to trade equal or up in value based on the property purchase price. And then you either get new debt or you put in more cash.
Interesting. Okay. using that same example, I borrow 500 grand, still, I'm still okay because obviously I took 100 grand to make up the difference.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So that's not a penalty. Well, what, when does boot kick in? What is boot? And it's probably not a good word. So,
but it's probably the most commonly used. So boot is really a taxable event or tax consequence. And it occurs in a couple of cases. One is you sell for $1 million, maybe you buy for 900,000. So you trade down by 100,000. And of course, we're ignoring closing costs. So in this case, you sell for 1 million, you buy for 900, you've traded down by 100,000. That would be taxable boot. You've not reinvested that last $100,000 amount. That'll be taxable. It could be that you sell for $1 million, you buy for $1 million. But in that last example, instead of replacing $600,000 in debt, you replace it with $700,000 in debt. So now you're only able to reinvest $300,000 of your equity and you have $100,000 cash left over that was not reinvested. That would be what they call cash boot. So that would also be a taxable event. So effectively, if you're trading down in value or you end up with cash left over, that's taxable boot and it's going to create a tax consequence.
And what is that tax at? How does the IRS look at that?
First, it's generally applied to depreciation recapture rates. So at the federal level, it's usually 25%. Okay. If you've owned the property for a very long time, it may be a different rate. So check with your accountant. Then once you've recognized all of your depreciation recapture, then it's applied to capital gain taxes. That is usually anywhere from 15 or 20%, depending on your adjusted gross income in your tax bracket. Then depending on the amount of gain, you might trigger the Medicare surcharge or depreciation recapture tax. The Medicare or the Obamacare tax. And that's the 3.8% tax that might kick in. And then, of course, you have state rate, whatever that might be.
I live in Florida at zero.
Bill, at the same time, you talked about it the other way. But what if I'm going to my relinquished property is going to get me $500,000? Can I go buy $300,000 homes?
Yes. So in that case, you're going to buy multiple properties. So as long as you buy two or three or four properties and they add up to the correct amount, so you've reinvested everything, then that would absolutely work. And that's a very common strategy because it allows you to sell one and buy two or three or four. So you're diversifying your investments. You've got multiple properties, multiple tenants. You've diversified your risk. Some people even buy those properties in different counties, different states, and diversify by geography. So it gives you a great way to really diversify your risk into different locations and multiple properties.
And then it's just up to me whether I want to do it cash or however I want to fund the rest of it, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Kind of wrapping up, what do you see as the biggest pitfall when people do exchanges, either they're a misunderstanding or mistakes that are made that are very costly for somebody doing their first exchange?
Usually the first one, it's lack of planning is probably the overall category. With 1031s, especially in markets like today, timing and planning is everything. And, bumps in the road are going to come up. So as long as you've got everything laid out, everything ready to go, your plan in place and something happens, you can probably deal with it. Those clients who just sell their property end up in their 45-day window and then start saying, what do we need to do? You've significantly increased your stress because you don't have a whole lot of days left. So it's all about planning. The biggest mistakes we see the most often are they forget the call and set up an exchange and it closes, so then it's taxable regardless. We get two or three of those calls every week. So that happens quite a bit. Second is they lose track of their timeline. So even though we remind people usually three times about the 45-day identification deadline, yeah, every week we get phone calls where they say, I missed the deadline. What do I do? It's like, there's nothing you can do. You can't backdate it and there's no ability to get an extension. So those are probably the most common that we see in terms of errors.
Okay. Whoop, sorry about that. I didn't expect to have my phone go off. Okay. I think we've done the subject, and I appreciate, trust me, I appreciate that we can trust you. And for me, you're the authority on this game of 1031 exchanges. And I hope it stays in place as I am about to do that. I don't want to hear the word retroactive on this subject at all.
Well, that's a good point. So we are part of a coalition that has been educating members of Congress and the administration on, you know, what is a 1031 exchange? How bad would it really be if you restricted or eliminated? The Green Book that came out has effectively said that the effective date would be January 1st, 2022. So that's good. That's the first time you've come out with a solid date. Obviously, that can change. That's the Green Book is nothing that's set in writing. It's not a bill. But that does give us an indication of what they're looking at. The lobbyists we talked to, 90% of them are saying, or the, all of them we talked to are saying 90% chance it will not be included in the bill. Obviously, there's that 10% chance that it could be. So it's all about educating members of Congress and the administration today about why this is a bad thing. And for you guys and listeners, if they want to help and they want to register their opposition to the change, they can go to 1031taxreform.com. So that's 1031taxreform.com. It takes about 2 minutes. You can actually log in, you punch in your home address, it automatically populates who your senator and your House of Representative members are. Then you hit submit and it just sends an email to them that says, I object. And that's all you have to do. It takes about 2 minutes. And we're hearing that that has been getting a really good response and it's having an effect.
That's fantastic. What's can you give your website for our people that might need your services?
Sure. It's exeter1031.com. So that's E-X-E-T-E-R 1031.com. Or they can call the headquarters office at area code 619-239-3091.
All right, Bill, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to talk
with us. My pleasure. Thanks for having us on. Take care.
Okay, we'll see you.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.